The next speaker is Dallas Burtrow, Resource for the Future. And the title of his talk is Federal and International Coordination of Climate Policies.
Thank you, Roger and Thomas and the College of France for inviting me today. I'm going to continue talking about the US, a bit of a US-centric talk, but with great relevance to the speakers and comments we've heard so far. So it was not very long ago that people with expertise in this room imagined an international system that would be comprehensive, efficient, and ambitious. And that hasn't come to be. And so the dilemma we face is, well, what is this still possible and what can replace it? I think one of the biggest challenges that economic thought has when thinking about the dilemma of climate change is the fact that economists are trained typically to think about nations as unitary actors and making unitary decisions. And I want to invoke a quote from a former US Secretary of Labor who made the profound observation that in most negotiations, he was talking about labor negotiations. In most negotiations, there's actually at least three negotiations. There's a negotiation over the table, and then there's a negotiation on each side of the table. And if you think about it in this context, it gives one a somewhat more nuanced and incremental sense of progress and history. So for example, we could think about Marty's remarks this morning about the importance of negotiating taxes across the table and reconcile that with the observation that what's on the ground within countries tends to be cap and trade and quantity-based approaches. So this is especially important in a federalist system. And I'm really motivated by a comment I heard from Ambassador Lawrence Tubiana, who said that the path to Paris is as much about finding out where we're going is finding out how we're going to get there. That's what I want to focus my comments on and think about the U.S. as a potential microcosm for the international situation. Okay, which is which? No? And how about that one? Okay. So this is a picture of where the U.S. is and how we got there over the last 10 years. In 2007, there was a lawsuit before the U.S. Supreme Court led by Massachusetts, in which the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the authority of the U.S. EPA to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. Remember that that was during the Bush administration when there was no progress being made on the national front. Well, then after the election of 2009, the Waxman-Markey bill passed the House of Representatives, and that was the background for Copenhagen. We were very optimistic about it. In 2010, the winds of political change blew. The Senate failed to take up the bill on the floor, and cap and trade was resoundingly declared dead. So dead that the president, who had really championed climate change action, did not mention climate change for 2 years in any political forum. But meanwhile, this freight train of the Clean Air Act had been initiated. It's like a freight train because it's slow, but it's very hard to stop. And the regulatory proceedings began, and the Clean Air Act measures began with an endangerment finding in 2009, that a formal finding by the US government of the danger of greenhouse gases. And under the Clean Air Act, that the unique situation of the Clean Air Act is the provision for citizen lawsuits. So that meant that once it was determined to be officially dangerous by the US government, the EPA was compelled to act to mitigate that harm. And that led to 2011 behind the scenes actions that were a very significant strengthening of motor vehicle standards and pre-construction permitting. So for the first time now and going forward, stationary sources, buildings, and other facilities have to consider greenhouse gases in their construction and permitting. And then in 2013, the climate action plan by President Obama on a sweaty day in Washington, D.C., a hot summer day, he announced his plan. In 2014, he brought out the provisions for the electricity sector, which are so important because they're responsible for 40% of the emissions in the US. And then in August of this year, the final Clean Power Plan. And what's really important to note about this, and that's why I have a picture of the states there, is that the this exercise of using the Clean Air Act is built on technical findings of what's been demonstrated achievable. This is language right out of the statute that's invoked for this. So it was necessary that there be demonstrated achievable technology options to achieve important greenhouse gas reductions. And those actions have been demonstrated by the states. And so it's a state-driven process that got us here, and it's a state-driven process that's continuing to lead the US. And were it not for the state-driven process, well, in some ways we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, because I think if the United States were not participating in a meaningful way in the Paris negotiations, the whole world would be much more dismal about the prospects in Paris. So I take a great comfort at the leadership that's happened at the subnational level in the US. So we invoke this term of approximate mirror to look at the US as a microcosm for what's happening internationally. We've moved from a top-down to a bottom-up world, and we hope there's new hope for agreement internationally. What does that look like? How might it come to be? And we look to the US as a microcosm for that. So background on this Clean Power Plan. I'm sorry for so much detail. I don't want to give you too much detail about it, but just to give you enough of a vocabulary so you know how to follow events in the US. The policy is implemented by the states using the statutory language in the law of identifying the best system of emission reduction. And this word system is very important because it's a technological part of the Clean Air Act, but the EPA has defined system to describe the electricity system, recognizing that the operation of a power plant in one section of the country affects prices and operation of plants instantaneously, really, in many other parts of the country. The states have to declare their intent for developing a plan to comply with what the EPA has directed them to do in 2016, final plans in 2018, and then compliance in 2022, with a number of provisions to incentivize early actions. So there's multiple pathways to the states, and this gets to the crux of what I want to talk about. States choose either a rate-based approach or a mass-based approach. So a rate-based approach is like a carbon intensity standard. It's an emissions rate approach, or the mass-based approach is like cap and trade or other types of policies. And the states have to demonstrate that the approach they're using is equivalent to the best system of emission reductions. The EPA has proposed a number of trade-ready model plans for rate and for mass to see if the states can trade with each other to capture economies of scale. So just to make sure everyone's firm on this, a rate standard is simply tons per megawatt hour. A mass standard is tons, and you can navigate back and forth between them by recognizing that tons per megawatt hour times megawatt hours gives you tons. Or states can do something entirely different if they want to do technology measures. Okay, so the advice from economists comes pretty readily. A mass-based approach compared to a rate-based approach is a potential pathway to comprehensive carbon pricing. So if we think of this as a bottom-up process that's coagulating or coalescing around an institutional design, economists would hope for and recommend that states take a mass-based approach. It will allow other sectors to be regulated under the Clean Air Act, and the Clean Air Act will come to other sectors. Pulp and paper, iron and steel, refineries, all have to be regulated in a similar way as the power sector has been regulated. So it's possible to coordinate that regulation around a marginal cost that's tied to the federal social cost of carbon. And there's been some language about that already. And in contrast, a rate-based approach is a dead end in that once you put a rate-based approach in place in the power sector, it's very difficult to imagine how you would coordinate that with other sectors of the economy. Also, I want to point out that this calibrating of these regulatory approaches to a social cost of carbon, you can look at what the states are doing now. There are 10 states in the US with cap-and-trade programs in place. And each of these have a price floor, which is operational through a reserve price in the auction. So that reserve price in the auction is a way to calibrate a cap and trade system with a national or international price. I would observe that actually all three North American programs, if we add in Quebec, all three North American cap and trade programs have such a reserve price in place. So there has been sort of a linking by degrees and learning from these programs as they've copied each other's institutional design. But the problem is, and the challenge is that observers suggest that there's a strategic advantage for states not to do a mass approach, but to do a rate approach. For one thing, a rate does not limit your emissions. So if you think you're going to be the exceptional one that grows tremendously, then you want to have room for that growth. And it may have a strategic advantage in multi-state power markets, where there's a lot of money to be made or lost. And this could lead to emissions leakage and undermine the whole program and the whole agenda for the United States. But it turns out that states may coalesce around a mass-based approach, even though some observers have pointed out strategic advantage of doing otherwise. And so I'm channeling now conversations that are happening in many states, and we've been a part of many of those. One consideration favors a rate-based approach. That is, they are concerned about growth. This is sort of like this possibility that there would be growth under a cap system and that prices might spike through the ceiling and you could not have further economic growth. This sort of the mythical beast that lives in the forest and has very rarely shown itself. But ex ante, it's what everyone's concern is. Ex post, it always turns out the prices in these cap and trade programs go down. They go down in large part because they behave the way economists anticipate they're going to behave to create incentives to look for ways to reduce emissions in ways that previously hadn't been thought of. Several factors are favoring a mass-based approach. First of all, the mass-based goals are not that hard to achieve. Secondly, the state plans are written by air quality agencies in the states that have experience with mass standards for other regulatory measures, other pollutants. So this plays to the literature by Cohen and Victor, who emphasize the importance of developing coalitions among proximate neighbors and building up around energy issues before you can build up to a grand international agreement. And that those coalitions are built through repeated interactions, and it's the air quality regulators that are going to be writing the rules for the states. And there's a number of other issues. Let me say that the last one is really the most entertaining, which is that just understanding emissions rate approach is very difficult for regulators. So they're pulled towards thinking about simplicity. So trading is allowed. Under a rate-based approach, you can do emissions rate trading, which is, if you haven't really thought about it before, it's initially kind of daunting. What does that mean? There's standards set for coal and natural gas plants. There's credit given for renewable energy efficiency. And you can trade megawatt hours across fuels and between states that use similar subcategorized rate-based approach. It's much simpler on the mass-based side. States are given a cap for existing sources and additional allowances if they include new sources under their cap. The new sources are regulated elsewhere under the Clean Air Act, and it's controversial and legally risky for the EPA to have mandated that states include new sources, but they're given incentives to do so. If states do not cover new sources, then they must have a renewable set aside and use updating output-based allocation to existing gas to provide incentives for continued utilization of those type of technologies in lieu of the build-out of a massive gas new gas infrastructure as a way to elude the cap. And facilities can trade tons with any other mass-based state. So the major concern, as I said, has been about leakage. And there's leakage takes two forms. One is that leakage may occur among states if a rate and a mass-based state are located next to each other, because a rate-based state creates a production incentive for facilities through the issuance of these emission rate credits, which are denominated in megawatt hours. That production incentive in those states, the facility automatically earns them under a rate-based approach for every megawatt hour that you generate. That's not obviously the case under a mass-based approach. And the distribution of emission allowances and the value implicit there is left up to the states. So in previous work that we talked about last year at a conference Thomas held, we show that the states can mimic the production incentive of a rate-based approach through the allocation of emission allowances under a mass-based approach, and that this leakage among states can be mitigated or actually reversed. Then there's a second type of leakage, which has everyone, including the White House, quite worried. And that is leakage to uncovered new sources, because as I mentioned, the states are not mandated to include the new sources in their cap and trade programs. The issue here is that the concern there's gonna be massive new gas build out, and states might want to allow growth. Well, updating output-based allocation to existing natural gas and renewables, as EPA has identified, can also mitigate this. And the EPA has drawn on this literature to write into its model rules that the guidelines for what the states should do to try to mitigate leakage. So to make this real clear, let me put up a table that shows the incentives that exist under different approaches. Under a rate-based approach, which is the first column, the eligible qualifying technologies that earn this production incentive for every megawatt hour they generate are the regulated coal emitting coal and existing gas facilities, and credits given to new renewables and new nuclear and new end-use efficiency. So under a mass-based approach with auction or grandfathering and excluding new sources, there's no production incentive given to any technology, and an implicit production incentive given to new gas because they are excluded from the cap, so they don't bear the opportunity cost of complying with the program. Under a mass-based approach with updating output-based allocation, you can surgically apply the value of the emission allowances to enhance production. Now, to economists, I'm sure it's not lost on anyone in this room, that there's a huge cost in doing this. You forgo the potential use of that revenue to do other things like a tax swap or whatever other types of value you might identify with the use of the asset values that created by introducing a price on carbon. But we're not talking about comparing a first best world and a second best world. We're talking about comparing a second best world and a third best world. And the third best world is one in which rate-based programs might scavenge any possibility we have in building the coalitions going forward. So this is the approach that the EPA has taken. And to see how this plays out in a merit order of the electricity system, here in this curve representing the upper Midwest part of the US, the blue squares and other shapes varying by technology show what the variable cost of operation would be under a carbon tax that's modeled in this case. And then the orange shapes display what happens with an output-based allocation to all technologies excluding existing coal. And you can see that generally they're systematically less, and I've circled a couple of them to just show specifically how they shift down. When the merit order is reordered, you see that there systematically is a lower dispatch curve. So you're maintaining a production incentive that rewards low and non-emitting technologies and avoiding this possibility of scavenging by neighboring states and strategic behavior is overturned. This is not something that we advocate should be done. The importance of this is it's an identification of the complete strategy set that's available states. It's an off-the-equilibrium path technology, if you will, strategy, if you will. In other words, just like someone who holds you up with a gun, you hope that they don't actually use the gun. But this is an allocation scheme that states can use to defend themselves as they go forward in the multi-state collaborative processes and negotiations. More generally, there's another solution that's much more satisfying, which is that if all the states introduce a comprehensive cap, and that cap includes new sources. So states have initial starting positions. They don't all start from the same position. And the leadership states, I mentioned that there's 10 of them, but actually there's about 20, in addition to the ones that have cap and trade in place, they've taken independently determined actions. A phrase that might be familiar from this morning's conversations. Over half the states have renewable and efficiency support policies in place. 10 states have emissions caps. Many of these states will have surpluses going into the program. So this picture represents a comparison of 2012 emissions and the goals that the states would be assigned under the Clean Power Plan. And red represents a deficit. So this is just if you freeze the world at 2012, and you see there's three or four states over on the left that have very little work to do, and then there's a lot of states that have a lot of work to do. And the scattered line represents, this is EPA's modeling of what happens if states have a go-it-alone strategy, don't trade with any other states, what is the marginal cost in those states? So over there in Idaho, the second one from the left, for example, that's a state with very few options, and it has a little bit of fossil, and so it has a really high marginal cost. But generally, it's helter-skelter throughout. But the world hasn't stood still since 2012. There's been a lot of action at the subnational level. And that is reflected in the picture here, where we see that a number of states, about 15 or 16 states, are going to be entering a 2020 or 2022 with a surplus of emission allowances. So their compliance gap is a negative gap, and other states have positive. Factors that affect this include gas prices and other regulations at the subnational level and reduced energy demand. So leadership states may exercise a form of Stackelberg leadership. in their program design, in essentially what Scott has referred to as a coordination game. This is one that's being played in over time in a dynamic setting, not just a one-shot game. And so conversations between the states are beginning, actually, between governor's offices are beginning in this realm. Several Western and Northeastern states in particular have a surplus. States with the surplus are thinking about two possible strategies. One is whether to sell at all or just hold their allowances off the market, because they recognize that these allowances, the clean power plant allowances that they'll have to sell, are made possible by other policies. So it would represent 100% leakage from the policies that they've already played, shown their willingness to take on costs domestically, if you will, to promote climate goals. The sale would yield revenues, but people point quickly out to whom do this revenue, do revenues accrue? If they accrue to the industry, that means we would say, jokingly from a US perspective, they accrue to people who live in Greenwich, Connecticut. The people who own, shareholders who own these companies, are not people who live in those states. Maybe it gets channeled back to ratepayers or whatever, but you already have seen demonstrated a willingness by states to be first movers on this. Or if the states decide to sell, this is what's really more interesting from Scott's perspective, states may sell only to those states that cover new sources under their cap, forming a U.S. climate club. So cheap allowances may influence the decisions of other states. So here I've shown you the same picture I've shown you before with the forecast that on the left we have very low prices, and on the right we may have high prices. And there's an overlap here. These states are faced with a choice. Do they include new sources and have access to the allowances from the green states in this picture? Or do they decide, no, we're not going to include new sources because we want to grow it. We want to be the exceptional state and grow, and then join the club that is, or then be essentially outside the club and be forced into a segmented market where there's much higher allowance prices. And you can think that after this begins and some states join the low price club, that the prices facing the remaining states are going to be even higher. So the question is there a pooling equilibrium that might lead to all the states following a strategic leadership move by California, Oregon, Washington, a couple upper Midwest states and the Northeast to make their allowances available onto the market only for states who design a program that adheres to certain functional approaches that could lead, in my mind, and in my hope, to a comprehensive carbon pricing in the US. So finally, let me just say, well, what if things fall apart? You probably are asking yourself this. So what if none of this really works out very well? Where does this leave the US? The climate clubs are also forming in through other linked activities. Power markets are involved and may enforce uniformity in the state plans. They've already very much let their opinions be known. That's where really most of the money is made and lost. The allowance market is in tens of billions of dollars. The power markets are in hundreds of billions of dollars. New York has reforming the energy vision, which is a restructuring the electricity sector that many other states are watching closely. Minnesota is, among many other states, are heavily promoting non-emitting resources. And California, of course, has its new renewable target of 50% by 2030. What's really interesting about that is that California it has a goal of 40% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, and only 20% of its emissions come from the electricity sector. That's where they know how to get the emission reductions from. So what's going to happen for the other 20% if they are to achieve their goals? That's going to be realized through expansion of the electricity sector into building a space and water, cooling and heating, through and scheduling of that through the electrification of those services and taking advantage of synchronizing them with the availability of renewables on the grid. And probably the most interesting thing of all is California legislation that passed in September. It opens up with a date certain by 2019. If it doesn't happen by 2019, the offer is taken away from the table. California is for the first time going to open up its independent system operator, which is the electricity system operator, to all the states in the Western grid, which is 11 Western states, large Western states, with many opportunities for investment in renewables in the West. So that I bring these points up to show that there are things happening on parallel tracks in addition to what's happening with respect to cap and trade under the Clean Air Act. Maybe it's not enough, but it is where we look to for hope these days. So to conclude, different goals and state policy flexibility under the Clean Power Plan invite strategic behavior and policy interaction, and that could increase emissions and degrade the air quality, one of the linked co-benefit issues that has come up earlier. But updating output-based allocation under mass-based policy and leadership and program design could conversely help to promote more efficient and effective policy through climate clubs. Thank you.